Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
My name is Bill. I'm not the teacher. I'm just one of the sangha here. And Carl gave me the invitation to talk, and so I said yes. And it kind of went around different ways for me, but it was similar because last week, if you remember, Carl gave a talk about silence. And he pointed out that was kind of paradoxical. This is a talk about the limits of talk. I did want to say something about the gatha of repentance, because this is how we kind of started. Carl and I were corresponding. If you remember, 2 weeks ago, Carl gave a talk about the gatha of repentance, and he then asked at the end of his talk, did anybody have anything they would like to say about it? And no one said anything. I think we were kind of surprised. So when I got home Sunday, I wrote Carl a note about it. And he liked what I said, so maybe that's why he asked me to give a talk. But when I did get a chance to think about it, the gatha of repentance helps me, especially because it comes at the beginning of our sitting. It reminds me that I'm not just coming here or sitting at home for a few moments of relief or escape. It sort of grounds me in the world and reminds me that I'm sitting not just for the time on the cushion, but also for some sort of broadening of my view. And the words, the evil karma words, don't have that kind of moralistic condemnation feeling for me. It's more like, oh, I'm just a human being, and my beginningless greed, hatred, and ignorance are really no different than anybody else's, and my conduct, speech, and thought are a reflection of that. And by sitting, I'm sort of being in that space, and it gives me some sort of respite from the greed, hatred, and ignorance, which in my conduct, my usual day, is like constant. I mean, the greed is what I always want. You know, I gotta have this, I gotta have that. Oh, I forgot about that. I gotta take care of this. And then the hatred is the things I don't want to happen and the things I'm always trying to avoid. And the ignorance is the fact that I don't even know that's going on all the time. So that was kind of what I was trying to tell Carl about, and he said, oh, that's good, because also Carl's been telling us recently that our practice is more than just our sitting on the cushion on Sunday mornings and at home. So that kind of fit into it. But then I had this opportunity to give a talk. I thought, well, I'm not really an expert on the Zen teachings or literature or anything the way that Carl is. And so I thought I would just tell a little story about my experience and then kind of what I've come to understand differently than when I started here. So if that's okay, I just wanted to tell a particular narrative. It's not the only narrative, but just a particular narrative of sort of what I came here with. And what occurred to me was that, you know, when I was a kid, I had a sort of a very innocent, sort of carefree childhood period. I grew up in South Orange, New Jersey, and I don't think there was anything really traumatic in my early childhood. But when I turned 13, I went to a very imposing institution called South Orange Junior High School, and to me, this was a traumatic experience. I had been in a smaller school with all my friends, and, you know, all we cared about was baseball, and I didn't think about it. I mean, it just seemed like life was fun. And school was not particularly scary because it was small. The teachers were very caring and supportive and everything. And then in September, I guess, of 63, something like that, all of a sudden I go to this big building, and there's lunchrooms and classrooms and hallways, and the teachers are really scary to me. Anyway, I hadn't experienced a challenge like this before. So I actually suffered from, I guess what I now would call anxiety. Time, I didn't know what it was. And I couldn't sleep at night. Very often I would be up late at night, and I hated being the last one awake in my household. I would try to make myself fall asleep before my parents, and of course, when you try to make yourself fall asleep, you know, it makes it worse. So for the first time, I was like unhappy. I didn't even know what that was. I was unhappy. And I was scared, and I was also ashamed because it seemed like the rest of the world was going on kind of blissfully ignorant of this state, and I didn't want to talk to my parents. I had two younger brothers, and they were, you know, they were happy in their childhood, so I didn't want to bother them. I don't know, it didn't occur to me to ask for help other than going to the library. Why? Well, I have a theory about that too, but so I went to the South Orange Public Library, and I must have somehow convinced myself that there was a solution to this misery, and it was in these books. And these books were, you know, like, they were written by great people because they were books, and they were, you know, published, and they were in a library, you know, and other people would read them and so forth. So I didn't know anything. I mean, I just started randomly taking books off the shelf in the philosophy section, which was the 100s in the Dewey Decimal System. You remember that? Yeah. And I thought, well, I'll figure this out. Somehow I'm going to figure this out. And instead, what happened was, all I did was I became a nerd. and I kind of identified with a intellectual trend that was popular in the 60s, which was existentialism. I don't think it's quite so popular anymore, but there was sort of this post-World War II French and German sort of, you know, depressing, melancholy kind of approach to life and literature and philosophy and writing. And I just ate it all up. I mean, oh, this is perfect. One of the books that I loved was called The Sorrows of Young Werther by Goethe. You know, I mean, this was his heartbroken young man, you know, and it was a series of diary entries and letters that he wrote. And, oh, God, I just loved it. But what happened was, instead of really finding any help, I just became this arrogant, intellectual nerd adolescent who thought he knew everything and could identify with Soren Kierkegaard or something like that. And that kind of stayed with me for a long time. And I think the other reason I might have gone to the library and what I brought to my practice when I first came here, in my family, I think, and in my, you know, my immediate circle, there was this value given to intelligence and being a smart boy or whatever that, and getting good grades and so forth. And I didn't think about that either. I just knew that that was somehow an important value. And so I kind of had this sort of perverse pride in being a good student and then reading all these, you know, important books and everything. I really wasn't aware of that either, and I kind of muddled through my life. I kind of got used to the anxiety. I developed all the regular defenses and vices, you know, about it that you get. It was a great opportunity when I learned how to smoke marijuana. That was a wonderful but temporary solution to my anxiety. And I was lucky because I never liked alcohol. It just never did anything for me. My friends would drink, and you know, I would have a drink, but it didn't help me at all. So I never really had a problem with that. But I had my vices, and I still have my vices that I use. So when I came here in October of 2002, I was still, unknowingly, I was still convinced that this was what I was looking for. I still wanted to find that great intellectual solution to the problem of worry and fear and old age sickness and death, as we call it now, and these existential issues. And I still had this belief that I could figure it out, or someone else had figured it out, and I was going to find it somewhere. It was hidden, but I was going to find it. It was really a shake-up when I kind of entered an anti-intellectual environment. And I don't mean that people were mean to me or anything like that, or putting me down, but the emphasis here is not and was not on figuring it out and on studying and explaining and talking and writing and reading. it was something that everybody called a practice. And that was really a challenge for me. And it was a good one. And I must have had a certain faith or conviction that there was something here, even though it wasn't recognizable to me in the way I went about things. And so I stayed with it. And there were a few things that inspired me that, you know, kind of kept me going as well. One day Carl gave a talk, which I still remember. This has got to be more than 10 years ago. And I think Carl had been a sailor or was involved in some sort of sailing club or something. I don't know if you had like were you part of like a race team or anything? But anyway, describe the a morning when he went out sailing, and it was a foggy day or something, and he went out into the bay, and his main concern was taking care of the boat and the wind and the sails and the course and following the right way to go and so forth. And the whole time that he was going around, he was getting soaked by the moist air. And when he got back, he realized that he was soaking wet. And he sort of analogized that to our practice, that we think we're here for a particular reason and we have some sort of therapeutic strategy in mind or particular goal, but we don't realize what's happening to us. Our focus is on something else, but behind the scenes, we're actually getting soaked. And so that was really a sort of a inspiring story for me and an analogy as to why to continue. And the other thing I always thought about when I heard the word practice was when I was a kid, you know, my folks would tell me you have to practice your piano or practice your clarinet. Later, I took the clarinet. And I hated it, just hated it. And yet, there was no way to get better at it by reading a book about playing the clarinet. You had to actually sit down, look at the paper, and play the notes. And then you had to play them again, and play them again, and play them again. If you didn't, your teacher knew you hadn't practiced. I mean, you know, you couldn't like fake it, say, well, I read about the clarinet last week. You know, that wasn't going to work. So I knew there was something else there about that sort of the need to repeat and to actually have that firsthand experience. A few years ago, there was a teacher. I went to a teaching. It wasn't this kind of meditation, but more Tibetan type. And he used an analogy that actually Leo used when I took Leo's classes on meditation. And he said, suppose you're faced with a glass. It's a clear glass of murky water, and you want to figure out kind of what's going on in this glass here, like how do I navigate this somehow? And I sort of recognized right away that there was a reference to, you know, sort of ambivalent situation in your life or something where, you know, you're not really clear about what's going on in your life. And what is our tendency usually? It's to keep stirring. You know, we want to keep stirring that situation, and we want to run it back and forth with our friends, and we want to think about it, and maybe, you know, we want to complain or whine, or we want to, I don't know, get really busy with some project or other. And he said, what if you let the glass sit there? What if it just, you didn't do anything? What if you just let it settle? What would happen? And, you know, I just like, this sort of just hit me like a 2x4. Because my style is always to be busy. And this was like, oh, wait. I mean, there's another way. You could sit still and see what happens. So that was another really important lesson. And also, you know, gave me again some more confidence in sitting. So I guess what I'm saying is I sort of came here for the wrong reasons, maybe, under false pretenses. But then, by coming back, the practice, the repetition, and not the least of which is the camaraderie here, one of the three jewels, Sangha, has had a really profound influence on me. And again, not intentionally, perhaps not in a cause and effect way, but over a long period of time. So I did want to share that. I wrote down all this stuff here, but I think I covered most of it. I did want to read a poem. By the way, last week Carl read the poem about First Snow, is it called? First. And I sent that out to some friends. I found it online, a Mary Oliver poem. And I found it online and I sent it out to some friends and we've been corresponding back and forth. That was another one of those great, great sort of teaching examples about silence and so forth. And this one is, this poem is by Tony Hoagland. I don't know if you guys know him, but he's probably about, I don't know, maybe about 5 or 10 years younger than me. And he doesn't write beautiful poems, but he writes sort of funny, thoughtful poems. And he suffers from the same kind of over-intellectualizing that I do. But he has a good sense of humor about it. And this one is called Misunderstandings. Oh, and he's also a teacher. He teaches, I think, at the University of Houston. He teaches writing, I guess, and poetry. Misunderstandings. I thought insulin was what they put in sleeping bags. I probably should not have called my class in feminist literature books by girls. When I compared humanity to a flower growing in the shadow of a munitions factory, it may be that I was not being fair to flowers. I thought someone was watching us and keeping score. I believed the desire for revenge was a fossil fuel that you could drive a lifetime on. I thought suffering had something to be said for it. I said, love me better or go to hell. I said, I will forgive when I am good and ready. I said, rumors of my happiness have been greatly exaggerated. I still don't understand why what I give and what I get back in return never seem to weigh the same. My favorite days were gray, troubled, moody, and infinite. Every time I plunged into cold water, I was happy in a way that can never be destroyed. I went 1,000,000 miles. I don't know why. Maybe some kind of quest, maybe to hide. All those years I kept trying and failing and trying to find my one special talent in this life. Why did it take me so long to figure out that my special talent was trying?
Thank you.
Thank you.